Accession number 28353, reel 16.
Were you helped or hindered by ministers on that point?
A bit of both, really, because ministers didn't want to spend any more money on defence, and therefore they recognised that to duplicate planning staffs, headquarter staffs, and even frontline forces would be uneconomic. On the other hand, they rather liked the idea of having a European capability, because they didn't want to be marginalised within Europe. So I think they wanted their cake and eat it. Yes, they wanted to be able to say, yes, we are committed to a European defence identity, but we certainly don't want to provide any money to provide a European defence force. That whatever we provide has got to be capable of operating within a European dimension, but also operating within a NATO dimension. And I think that's the right answer, personally. Other things that took time as Commander-in-Chief was the Franco-British European Air Group. It had started during Mike Graydon's time, when he was chief, as purely a Franco-British initiative. The French felt very aggrieved during Gulf War I, because they were marginalised completely by the Americans. Although they provided forces, as you will recall, for Gulf War I, they had political constraints on them, so to some degree they weren't able to operate as freely as the coalition would have liked the French forces to be able to do. And certainly once we got into the no-fly zones after Gulf War I, the French, although they were there, didn't fly and didn't operate. All they did was to train. They didn't come under the coalition command structure. And the French, I think, felt very aggrieved about this, because they'd actually provided quite a lot of input into Gulf War I. And the only way that they felt they could get into the American camp was through us. They knew that we'd got a good relationship. And they even went to the point of actually unusually putting their squadrons under our local command on bases in Saudi Arabia, etc., in order for them to be able to get a bit of the intelligence in order to operate. And so quite a close relationship between us and the French in the aftermath of Gulf War I, and the setting up of this Franco-British European Air Group, whose function was really not to... Well, the French would have liked it to have been a very big, sort of to develop a command headquarters type posture. We did not want it to do that. So we said, no, let's first of all set it up to provide greater coordination between our two air forces, so that we are better able to interoperate and collaborate together on operations. But we're not actually going to have any command function held by this group, although the French wanted that. We set it up with a headquarters at High Wycombe, under the overall auspices of CNC Strike, and then other nations within Europe wanting to come on board. So from starting out as a Franco-British air group, it then became a European air group with members such as Italy, Spain, Portugal, Holland, all joining initially as members in attendance and then eventually full members, and so growing to some seven nations, I think, whilst I was there at High Wycombe, and now is probably sitting at about eight or nine different nations, but still very much a coordinating group, not making policy, but providing papers on which policy decisions can be taken, and certainly without any command function, but actually has been quite a useful group and has got some quite reasonable work done.
It does seem to be the case that the French all the time somehow trying to chip away at... on the one hand, they try to chip away at our relationship with the Americans, mm-hmm. and on the other hand, they're trying to increase, if you like, a European position.
Yes.
But would it be the case that if one is going to do that successfully, you'd have to massively increase spending by the principal European nations?
Well,
defense?
Yes, I think you would, because the Europe as a whole does not spend enough money on defence, particularly when you bear in mind that each nation is supporting its own national industry and so forth, and therefore there's not the same degree of commonality of equipment across in the national borders. So if you're going to set up a European Defence Force, then that is going to be very expensive. Fortunately, to say, I think most nations have recognised that we should use the forces allocated for NATO for a European operation if NATO doesn't wish to be involved, and that's the sort of the arrangement at the moment, although there are now separate planning staffs to a degree, not totally replicated in terms of matching what NATO does, but certainly to a degree of self-authority outside of NATO. But France's intention very much so to weaken the authority of America within Europe and within NATO, and obviously try and achieve a greater European capability under its sort of leadership. I think the only other thing I think I'd just like to sort of introduce, I've always enjoyed my flying and done as much of it as I can at any one time. When I was a group commander, I obviously flew all the aircraft in my group. So it was ASC 38 group. I managed to get myself in a short time checked out on the various air transport and tanker aircraft that we had. When I was ASC 1 group, I was certainly during my 2 years at the group, I was flying sort of 10 different types of aeroplane, half as captain and half as non-captain. At Strike Command, I decided that again I would try and fly a reasonably broad spectrum of aeroplanes, so again I would go and fly a little bit of each. I wouldn't, my predecessor at Strike Command, John Allison, who probably did as much flying as anybody else, tended to concentrate on two aeroplanes and maintain real currency on those aeroplanes, one on the F3, which he was very used to, and the other on the Hawk, which he used for flying himself around the command. I decided I wanted to try and fly all the different aeroplanes, but clearly to a lesser depth of capability, which is what I did, and used 32 Squadron, the Northolt sort of squadron, to get me about from A to B, rather than using a Hawk to do so, which was actually more room for luggage and things of that nature. But what I did do was I got myself checked out on 32 Squadron so that I could fly the 125 and the 146, as well as the helicopters. So, by and large, wherever I went, I would fly myself in their aeroplanes. And I thoroughly enjoyed that. It was a great relaxation. And,
When you say checked out, in order to fly these aircraft, you didn't have to do a conversion course.
Yes.
That's what checking out means.
Yes, I went off and did a course on each aeroplane. It wasn't a long course. Took about sort of, a week or a fortnight or something of that nature. But yes, yeah.
And this was a full week. In other words,
yes.
In the evenings you had to go and do your...
I go and do my day job, yes.
Go do your day job.
Yes, yeah. But it meant then that I could fly in the left-hand seat with a training captain in the right-hand seat, but I could fly passengers in that respect because I had done sufficient flying to know all the emergency drills and things of that nature. Although probably in an emergency the training captain would have taken over the flying the airplane, I would have been sufficiently well-versed in the airplane to be able to help him and things of that nature. And I used to do the simulator every 6 months and so forth, just to get, keep myself within the currency requirements to be able to do what I was doing. And and so I think we've got just about to March 2000, which is when again I took over from Dick Johns as CAS.
When did he mention this for the first time?
I suppose I knew about it certainly with 9 months to go. So I would have known about it by sort of the summer of 99, that was what his intention was, although it wasn't made public at that stage. It probably wasn't made public until about the September of 99, but I think I knew for certain, sort of before we stacked for sort of summer leave, as it were, so July, August 99. Although I suppose, because of what had happened to John Allison and so forth, it was looking that way, although it wasn't totally beyond the bounds of possibility that somebody called Anthony Bagnall couldn't have taken over as CAS. I didn't think it was going to happen, but it certainly wasn't beyond the bounds of possibility. My own view was that I suppose I would have been disappointed not to have got to be CS, having got to being CNC Strike, but actually I had always said that if I am able to command Strike Command, which is perhaps for the last 5 or 6 years what I saw as being my aspiration, I would have actually been very happy. I don't think I would have been bitter in any way. I might have been disappointed, but I wouldn't have been bitter if I had retired from being CNC Strike Command, because as I say, I think for the last 5 or 6 years leading up to that, that's what I really wanted to do, and if I did that, that would be absolutely fine. And also, I might have got 3 years of doing it rather than only one. But so if I had retired from being CNC Strike, I would certainly not have been bitter in any way, and I would have enjoyed my service career enormously. Clearly, being invited to be the chief is a huge privilege. It's probably not so much fun as being CNC Strike Command, but it is a huge privilege, and something I now look back on, of course, as being a wonderful experience. But I don't think I would have thrown, well, I wouldn't have thrown my toys out of the cot if Dick Johns had come to me and said, look, I've been watching you for the last year, and I've decided that Tony Bagnall ought to replace me rather than you, or what have you. But he didn't, so in March 2000, I took over from him. The Secretary of State was a chap called Jeff Hoon. The Permanent Under Secretary was Tebbit. There were three Chiefs of Defence Staff in my time as CAS. Firstly, Guthrie, then Boyce, and finally Mike Walker, just for a few months. And there were two Vice Chiefs of Defence Staff in Admiral Abbott, Peter Abbott, and then Tony Bagnall, person I've just mentioned. So those, I suppose, were the key players at the highest level in my time. If I can just talk a bit about Hoon for a moment, because I think he was and is a very good Secretary of State for Defence. He's different from Portillo, and I alluded to that before, in as much although he has got a lot of link with the Prime Minister, his relationship with Brown is not a particularly good one, and therefore if resources were involved, it was always difficult for him to say this is a done deal, because he wouldn't beat Brown, and to beat Brown he needed Blair's support. Blair didn't give it often, although he was, I think, inclined to support defence, because he knew it was what kept him on the international stage as much as anything, and he liked using defence, you know, in here, there and everywhere. But he, Blair, was not prepared to take Brown on because of the, you know, the lack of working relationship between the two men. So Hoon, therefore, not as effective as Portillo in that respect, but I thought a very good man to work for. He was a man who could make decisions. Once he made a decision, he would stick with it, regardless of pressure, and I'll come on to one particular instance of that. He was a pleasant man to work with. Again, he was not a charismatic man. He was the Secretary of State. He was not a charismatic man. He found going out and meeting the soldiers, airmen and sailors, pressing the flesh, which most politicians do easily and well. He didn't find that easy. Personally, that didn't worry me too much, because the chiefs could do that as well as he, or the operational commanders. What I was keen to have as a Secretary of State is somebody who will make a decision, who will stick to it and fight the Whitehall corner when it's needed, and he would do that, albeit he was not as strong as Portillo in terms of taking on the Chancellor. He needed to rely on the Prime Minister to support him. Blair did from time to time do so, but although Blair used defence a lot to maintain his position on the world stage, would not take Brown on very often because of the non-relationship between those two men. The permanent Under-Secretary was a man called Tebbit, who came from the Foreign Office, and I thought was a breath of fresh air vis-a-vis his predecessor. But I was disappointed with Tebbit in the end, because I felt that he wasn't as strong a man as I would like to have seen in the post, and moreover, he was somebody who came to meetings, particularly when he was chairing meetings, like the Defence Management Group. He would come with his solutions to the problems, which all good chairmen do, but he made it very obvious, because he wouldn't necessarily listen to people when they were actually making their arguments, and yet would summarise and come out with a conclusion that he clearly wanted right from the word go. You got the impression that the minutes were written before the meeting started. I worked for three CDSs. First of all, Guthrie, then Admiral Boyce, and then General Mike Walker. I didn't work with Walker for long, but I know that we would have got on well, because we got on well as single service chiefs. I enjoyed working for Mike Boyce, who I thought was a very straight man indeed, very conscientious, a workaholic in the true sense of the word, but a very straight man, and I think pretty purple. Guthrie I found more difficult, a very likeable man, very jovial, good company and things of that nature, but manipulative and frustrating sometimes in the extreme, particularly over trying to get senior appointments where there was a debate to be had between the three services as who was the best candidate for the job. The outcome of those meetings, where he of course had the casting and deciding vote, was sometimes immensely frustrating, because you were quite sure that you'd come out from the meeting with an answer which was one to meet his agenda, rather than necessarily getting the best man for the job. So I didn't find him an easy person to work for.
And so would you say that he was a particularly purple CDS, as they mentioned?
No, I don't think he was particularly. I feel that he was undoubtedly army-centric. I've sort of divided up things, I think, and this sort of in headings. And first of all, operations. A lot of operations during my 3 years as CAS, ranging clearly from the no-fly zones over northern southern Iraq, which had been going on since 1991-92, but very much in evidence, and getting more demanding during my time. We went through Desert Fox, which was one particular spike in the no-fly zone operations in the south, and of course eventually deteriorated into the Gulf War II position. We were involved in Sierra Leone twice, and then there were the operations in Afghanistan in 2002, following the attack on the World Trade Center in September 2001. Obviously, as CAS, without if you like, day-to-day command responsibilities, but nevertheless, during times of operations and crisis, the Chiefs of Staff Committee, chaired by CDS, meeting regularly, either every day or once a week or what have you, looking to the Chiefs to provide advice on how forces should be employed. So my own ideas, obviously, from the Air Force, but I would also keep in close contact in that respect with the then CNC Strike Command, Air Chief Marshal John Day, to make sure that I was up to date with what was going on with the forces under command and giving advice to the CDS. Gulf War II, I think, is worth talking about for a moment because of the controversy, if you like, over whether it was the right or the wrong thing to do. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that all the evidence that we were given as chiefs from the intelligence community indicated that Hussein had a program of weapons of mass destruction on the chemical and the biological side. We knew that he was working towards a nuclear capability, but equally we knew that he wasn't there yet and that it would be some years before he was. But all the evidence, and there was a lot of it, pointed to him having a chemical and biological capability. We were shown satellite imagery and so forth, very clear satellite imagery, which, for example, showed that whilst the inspectors were being held up at the front door of a particular facility that they had suddenly said, we want to go and inspect, vehicles and things of that nature were leaving the back door. We had clear evidence of that. We had evidence of where, again, they had been for inspections, that somebody had raked over all the ground outside the back to get rid of whatever had been there. Now, in the light of what we found so far, was he actually shipping stuff out and getting rid of it, or was he actually doing that knowing that we would get satellite photography which would persuade us that he did have a capability that he didn't have? I don't know what was in Saddam's mind, but there is no doubt that we were provided with persuasive evidence that they had a chemical and biological program, not only from the photographs but also by insiders who talked about it and things of that nature. So I, as CAS, was absolutely sure that he had a program of weapons of mass destruction. That said, it was not a program that was weaponized so that he could attack the United Kingdom from Iraq. We knew that. He had no missiles or any system that could actually attack the UK direct, other than through agents delivering some sort of capability out of a suitcase. So I think my own view that the 45-minute issue was misleading, because there was no doubt in my mind that he couldn't attack the United Kingdom in 45 minutes. And I think that was allowed to be portrayed in such a way that certain members of Parliament and bits of the nation felt that that 45-minute threat applied to the United Kingdom, not just to deployed forces in theatre, which is actually what the assessment was. We did feel that he had a capability of attacking forces in theatre within 45 minutes of somebody at the top saying fire shells or whatever it happened to be. So, if you like, therefore, we did believe he had a WMD, which was, of course, the basis for the UK stance on going to war. And this was the difference between ourselves and the Americans. The Americans said we must get rid of Saddam, and if we get rid of Saddam, we will sort out the weapons of mass destruction. Blair, because he wanted UN support and would not get it if we were going just for weapons of mass destruction, if we were going just for the regime change, said, no, we're going for weapons of mass destruction. If that means we have to replace Saddam to do so, then so be it. So it was the other way around. In the event, of course, we didn't get the second resolution from the United Nations. But obviously Blair and everybody else, or not everybody else, Blair and Bush felt that 1441 was sufficient basis for going to war. In terms of the planning for it and giving advice to ministers, chiefs were very concerned that we needed to be, and I think Mike Walker and I, when he was CGS, probably most out of the chiefs, felt that we wanted to be sure that we had got a winning formula. And that winning formula was not just for the operational phase, but it was for the post-operational phase as well. And that without that, we really would be, you know, we would be taking a risk to go to war at all. Now, initially, if we look just at the phase three side, as it was called, which was the operational side, that was confounded to a degree by our lack of access to bases in Turkey, which prevented us being involved with the Americans in a major spearhead from the north, whilst the Americans came in from the south. And that was the original thing, that we would link with the Americans and come in from the north through Turkey, and America would go into the south as well. And because Turkey turned us down, we couldn't do that. So for a while, again, we didn't have a true winning formula. Eventually, we had enough time to redirect everything, put the outload of air into the Middle East, bring ground forces in through the Middle East as well, and so eventually we knew we'd got a winning formula or a winning plan for phase three, and so we went into it knowing that we would win the operational phase. So Mike Walker and I had no concerns about that at all. But phase four, which was the aftermath, frankly was always a great concern to the chiefs, and particularly again to Mike Walker and myself and Mike Boyce, who was the CDS. But there seemed to be very little that we could do about it. Frankly, Washington didn't seem to get its act together. They appointed somebody, Garner, to look after Phase 4, who was probably too old both in mind and body, so he was probably the wrong man to choose. But even if he was the right man to choose, because of the infighting in Washington between DOD, State Department, etc., and the White House, he was working with one arm tied behind his back. So he was never going to actually make the fast progress in stabilizing the country that was so essential. And I think a degree of reluctance to accept on the American side that phase four started the moment that phase three started, because as soon as you've bypassed one village in southern Iraq or northern Iraq, there's really the forward line of own troops has gone past one, but that bit is already into phase four, even though the battle isn't won. But the battle for that village's hearts and minds and that sort of thing has started. And they never, I don't think, came to terms with that. And therefore, they kept saying, yep, don't worry, you know, we'll have it all in place by the time phase three is finished. But we knew that you had to start before. Now, why didn't we, therefore, as a nation, do more about it? Well, I think at the end of the day, Washington undoubtedly ruled the roost. But also, of course, we had Clare Short leading on behalf of the UK government, and Clare Short's heart wasn't in it. She resigned halfway through, so frankly her organisation again never really got to grips with this problem, because she just wasn't involved or wasn't prepared to give it her best shot. We in defence tried very hard to get the government to appoint a specific minister to oversee, you know, the Foreign Office aspect, the Clare Short's department interest, the MOD, set up a separate sort of almost Secretary of State for Phase 4. The Foreign Office wouldn't have that, so it never got established. So when we came to, if you like, the point where, as chiefs have been saying all the way along, you know, we don't have an answer frankly to phase four, we're happy, oh Prime Minister, with everything for phase three, but we don't have an answer to phase four, you know, we come and go, don't worry, you know, that'll be sorted, and eventually you find yourself on the day before the attack, you still haven't got the answers, but the Prime Minister decides to go ahead anyway, and that's frankly the way it was. But none of us were happy with what had been done for phase four. We all knew that we would only have a certain amount of time after the conflict before if you like, public support within Iraq would start dropping away. And what happened was, I think, we didn't get the slope of consent, if you like, was never as steeply up as it should have been, because we hadn't done enough work, and it started to decay much sooner than we hoped it would. And so, you know, we are where we are, I'm afraid. What more one could have done about it, I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I suppose, in extremis, you know, the chiefs perhaps ought to have been even firmer in their views through CDS to ministers that, you know, that we're not ready because we haven't got the phase four side. But to an extent, that wasn't our responsibility. Our responsibility was to make sure we could win phase three, and that was accounted for. We knew that for the whole operation, phase four needed to be properly set up, but it wasn't our lead. And although we could say, you know, we don't think we've got a winning concept for the whole thing, what we were being asked, can we win phase three? Yes, we can.
This is most interesting because this is, again, the chiefs of staff spotting a, what is in effect really a political problem, which isn't being addressed,
yes.
Which is exactly what David Craig, when he was CDS, said he came across in Gulf War One,
yes.
When there just wasn't, they just didn't address, the UK government and the US government didn't address